Hey, Science Decoders, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Science Decoded. It's your host, Justin Dingman, and today we're going to be talking about plants in space. So stay tuned. You're going to want to hear about this one. Trust me. We do have some sci-worthy news and some Science Decoded news. If you're curious about how technology might be impacting your daily life, we actually have some recent articles on that. So if you go to our website at sciworthy.com, go over to the categories tab, and you can check out our latest articles on a variety of categories and questions, but also specifically the impact of technology. Recently, scientists taught a computer how to play the Settlers of Catan. If any of you guys like that board game and want to know more about that and how they did that, feel free to check the article out. Also, we will be possibly trying out a new dynamic on this podcast where we'll be getting together with a panel of other scientists and other members involved in scientific communication, and hopefully we'll be able to come together and have some really important discussions on what it means to communicate science, what that looks like effectively, how important that is to our constituents and the people who are paying the taxes and allowing us to have these grants to conduct our research, and how we need to be able to be held accountable and report back to you guys, the constituents, and as well as the United States government. We may be talking about research ethics and a slate of any other topics or any other questions that you, the audience members, may come up with. So feel free to write us in if you have any questions or comments or would like to direct one of our discussions. You have all of our brains on that. It's going to be myself, our editor Gina, our other editor Garrett, and I think Osama might be stopping in to join us as well. So let us know what your thoughts are on that, and feel free to send us some topics for some great discussions. So it's time for another tip on how to tell if a source is trustworthy or not. In today's day and age, a big problem in our ever increasingly opinionated media is this idea of false balance. When discussing false balance, it's important to ask yourself, how does the content creator handle multiple perspectives? Sometimes content creators will give lip service to another perspective's appearance to appear impartial when they really aren't. Are they misdirecting the reader with something mundane? Are they mistakenly giving equal weight to perspectives that are supported by evidence and other perspectives that aren't? Are they setting up a straw man only to tear it down instead of representing views that they disagree with in the best light possible? This can be a hard one to pick out. And it also requires the identification of what counts as evidence. Determining what is evidence and what isn't evidence is an entirely other topic. However, it's important you begin to ask yourself these questions as you begin to dive in more into your own research, and when you ask yourself questions about the content that keeps coming at you in this day and age. Ask yourself, how are these multiple perspectives being handled? Is there proper evidence for both of these perspectives? And I think as you begin to find answers in both of those things, you'll begin to get a clearer picture exactly what this content is trying to communicate to you. So for today's topic, in 2021, space research reached new heights, including the launch of the largest and most expensive space telescope in the James Webb. However, the most exciting development for astronauts came aboard the ISS with one simple meal, tacos. Growing and maintaining a fresh supply of food and vegetables is vital to an astronaut's physical and mental health. Therefore, it has become important for NASA to invest time and resources into space farming, for lack of a better term. And no, I'm not talking about floating cows. Currently, astronauts receive their meals in freeze-dried or pre-packaged form, shipped to the ISS on quarterly supply missions. Much of this food can be bland and not very tasty. So last year, researchers helped astronauts grow green chilies aboard the ISS, providing some much-needed flavor and spice into their diet. As our understanding of what plants need and how they react to the conditions aboard the International Space Station grows, so does our ability to grow a wider variety of plants and vegetables. This allows us to plan future trips deeper into space as we learn the best way to sustain ourselves. The ISS also conducts experiments with plants in order to help scientists better understand what it'll look like to eventually grow crops on the moon or on Mars, which will be useful in the event we begin to colonize other celestial bodies. NASA currently has two main ways of growing plants aboard the space station. There is Veggie and the Advanced Plant Habitat, known as APH. NASA's Veggie system is about the size of a carry-on piece of luggage and typically holds about 6 plants. Each plant grows in a pillow of soil and clay-based growth media and fertilizer. The pillows are important to help distribute the water, nutrients, and air equally around the roots. Otherwise, the roots would either drown in water or be engulfed by air because of the way fluids tend to form bubbles in space. This is due to the force of their own gravity that they actually exert on themselves. The APH, however, is similar to Veggie, but it is completely automated and controlled by a ground crew at Kennedy Space Center, and is used for research studies aimed at investigating the events that low levels of gravity might have on crops and other plants. When we get back, we'll be talking with Dr. Lucy Pillay, a NASA researcher who most certainly has a green thumb, about all things plants in space. Well, welcome back to Coders. We've got a really exciting episode for you today. We're joined by Dr. Lucy Pillay. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Hello, everyone.
Before we get started, Dr. Pillay, can you give us a little bit of information on your background in education?
Yes. So my background is in engineering. It was not a straightforward path, so I'll give a little bit of information about that. I'm from France, so I started my studies in France, and I did an engineering school there, general engineering. Usually engineering schools in France, you do a preparatory course of 2 years, and then you have the school itself, which is 3 years. Mm-hmm. And instead of going to my third year, I did an internship year, a gap year. And I had the opportunity to do an internship at the European Space Agency. And that was awesome. And I discovered the project MELISSA, which is Microecological Life Support System Alternative. Mm-hmm. And this project is a research project on a closed loop for space missions.
Ooh.
So when I say closed loop, I mean recycling the wastes and recycling the wastes using microorganisms, algae and plants, so that the plants and the algae are fed with the produce of degradation of the wastes and use the CO2 of the crew, and they produce oxygen and food and fresh water for the crew. So that's the idea of MELISSA. I discovered this whole field of bioregenerative life support systems and plants in space during this internship. And then at the same time, at the beginning of this internship, I got accepted into a master's program at Purdue University in aerospace engineering. So I did this master's degree instead of my third year of engineering in France. That was like a double diploma kind of thing. So after my internship at the European Space Agency, I moved to Purdue in Indiana. And I spent 2.5 years there. I completed my master's degree and I stayed a little bit longer working in the lab where I did my thesis. And I was working with Dr. Mitchell in the horticulture department. So that's the interesting part. I was doing my master's in aerospace engineering, but I was working in the horticulture department. He was researching on growing plants in space, and he had these really interesting lighting system, smart lighting system for plants. So that's what I did research on. And that's also where I discovered research, because during my engineering studies, there was no way I was going to do research. I just wanted to work as an engineer. And I discovered applied research at this occasion, and I decided to go for a PhD. But that was not straightforward either. After my master's in aerospace engineering at Purdue, I moved back to Europe. And I worked for the German Aerospace Center, DLR, as a research associate in team in the Institute of Space Systems. And we were working on mostly greenhouse modules for space and things like that. And after 2 years there, I was still interested in doing a PhD. I had my thoughts on that had matured, and I found a position at the University Clermont Auvergne in France. And I moved to France to do my PhD there. That was in January 2015, and I defended in July 2018. And then 6 months later, I moved to Kennedy Space Center as a NASA postdoc.
That's awesome. And yeah, for many of our American listeners, they may not understand a lot of the educational differences between France mm-hmm. and the United States. Yeah. You know, when you graduate from high school in France, you have to take Le Bac, and you kind of already have an idea of what career you want in mind. And
yeah, that's true.
Those pathways are a lot more windy, like you said, but I think it's a really good example, you know, your journey of how anyone can end up, you know, wherever they want.
Yeah, my BAC, which is the final exam at the end of a high school, was the scientific option. So I had done a lot of math, physics, and biology, not engineering yet. And yeah, that's the topics that counted the most for these exams.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Poulet, what are your primary responsibilities in your field? And, you know, what do you do really for a living every day?
As I said, I'm a NASA postdoctoral fellow. As a postdoc, so I'm in the spacecraft production group. And we have our main research project, but we also are integrated within the team and we work with the team here at KSC. So my main research project, the research project on which I wrote the grant to get here, is to study the interaction between photosynthesis and ventilation in reduced gravity environments, because gravity has an impact on convection, and that influences how photosynthesis is done with plants. So this is where my interest lied. And so I designed some experiments to be done in the lab, and I have a model that I developed during my PhD that I can feed the data I get from the experiments in the lab. So this is something I do. Then while being here, I also got involved in the experiment on the advanced plant habitat that is currently on the International Space Station. And you may have heard that chili peppers are growing in the advanced plant habitat right now. I was fortunate to have colleagues include me on these experiments, because we are right now, this week actually, collecting data on photosynthesis and different ventilation on peppers. So I will be able to use this data and look at it with the eyes of my model. So this is really exciting. And I wrote grants, and one of them got awarded. The project is about harvesting microgreens in microgravity. Harvesting them in microgravity can be really messy because they're really small. So if you cut them all at once, they will start floating everywhere. So we designed a system that will enable us to harvest them easily and bag them right away. And we designed different systems and different methods. And this is what we're going to test next week. And it included a parabolic flight. Being a NASA postdoctoral fellow is amazing because you come in with a research project, but then you have lots of opportunities that arise while you're here. This is the kind of things researchers do. So this is, yeah, the daily job of a postdoc at NASA.
Well, that's awesome. And it's a lot of really great work to kind of further science and further the next generation of scientists as well. So today we're going to be focusing specifically on a paper published in November, Crew Time in Space Greenhouse Gas Using Data from Analog Missions and VEGGIE. Can you tell us kind of what the purpose of the study was and what its implications are?
Yeah, it all started with a workshop we had in August 2019. Our colleagues from the Eden ISS group at the German Aerospace Center who came in and had a presentation. And part of the data they presented was about crew time. And then we sat down with them and I told them, okay, look, I also have data about crew time in other analog facilities. And then my other colleague, Jess Bonchek, she said, yeah, we also have crew time data for VEGGIE. And altogether, we thought, okay, this is really interesting and we should definitely publish this data, because when you look for crew time within a greenhouse module in the literature, you don't have a lot of things. A lot of time these data is not recorded and it's hard to find it. So what happens is in a lot of feasibility studies for greenhouse modules on the moon, on Mars, or elsewhere, people who are planning this mission, when they want to estimate how much crew time is needed to operate the greenhouse, a lot of these numbers are guessed. So we thought, okay, we are going to publish the data we have, and this will be a baseline.
Yeah, it sounds like you took this data from these analog missions, or these missions that are designed to simulate what may be going on the International Space Station, and to collect data on what it's like to be a crew member cultivating these vegetables that you're going to need eventually at some point to eat, right? Especially if we're going to be self-sustaining moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. Really what we wanted to do is develop a methodology so that people who are running analog missions, for example, could, and with greenhouse modules, could use, so that when they report crew time, it is done in a systematic way. The intention of these paper and this study originally was to start a methodology for a better reporting of crew time in this environment.
And you touched on this a little bit in your answer, but was there anything during the research process that was easier or harder than you initially expected?
Easier, I don't know. Harder, for sure, the fact that this data was hard to compare. We really wanted to compare them, but the systems were so different. What we could observe mostly is how hard it is to have a universal system to compare crew time for greenhouse modules. So this was the first thing we noticed, and it encouraged us even more to develop these categories for crew time reporting.
Yeah, it sounds like you really used your methodology to kind of defeat some of the challenges you were facing when asking these questions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how exactly did you go about analyzing so much data from so many different studies to draw these conclusions?
We had our colleagues at the Eden ISS who had their own data, and they reorganized them according to the categories we had collectively defined. Our colleague who was working on veggie, this is also what she did. Then I was in charge of the analog missions. And when I talk about the analogs, I'm referring to these space analogs, these missions that are specifically designed to reproduce a space mission on Earth. And they had also a planned growth system. For the analogs, at first we thought, okay, maybe we can look at the crew time per square meter. But even that didn't really make sense because the systems were so different. So we ended up just comparing them, knowing that one was bigger.
So with all this talk about space farming, some of our audience members might be interested in knowing, you know, how much labor is exactly involved in growing plants or vegetables in space?
That's a great question. While I was at the German Aerospace Center, one of the projects we worked on was a greenhouse module for the moon. And we looked at crew time, and with the estimates we had at that time, we saw that we would need a crew member in the greenhouse full time, so 8 hours per day. So it was, you know, a little bit of an extreme case, I would say. But in terms of labor, right now with the technologies we have, this is what it would take, someone full time. What we say in our paper is that for longer duration mission and larger scale mission, it would be interesting to have more automation of the system for sowing, for harvesting, for health monitoring, watering, everything.
I feel like everything in microgravity or low gravity just takes more effort and more time. And I'm sure some people really struggle with growing plants as is, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And the first systems will probably be smaller size and mostly for supplementing the diet and bring some vitamins, because that's one of the reasons we grow plants in space. But then, you know, as missions become longer and destinations further from the Earth, then we want to have maybe a bigger part of the diet that is grown in situ. And for that, then we will need to transition from leafy greens and supplemental food to plants that are more nutritious or bring a different type of nutrition with more carbs, more proteins, more fats. And that requires different techniques of growth as well. And of course, larger growth areas.
Absolutely. So on Earth too, some people kind of have this phrase of, you know, growing things requires a green thumb. And some people definitely feel like they have the talent to grow plants and other people don't. Do our analog astronauts or even our astronauts on the ISS ever experience this?
So I would not say it's a question of green thumb on the ISS. It's, let's say that some astronauts like it better than others to take care of plants, and they are more drawn to to the systems, and they go look at the plants even if it's not scheduled on that day, you know, just to check on them. And we've had that. The green thumb, as it is now with the systems we have with Veggie and the advanced plant habitat on the International Space Station, it's down to the ground crew mostly, because everything is really assisted by the ground crew. The seeds are seeded here on Earth, and everything is sent like this in the rocket. And then when it arrives on the station, it's just assembled in the system, and the astronauts just add water, and they add water in the quantities that the ground instruct them to. And then when it comes to, you know, thinning the plants or opening the wicks or checking on the plants, it's all written into procedures as well. So let's say that there is not a lot of room for improvisation for the astronauts at the moment. And some of them, the ones that are really implicated into these plant growth experiments, then they want to take initiatives and they ask the ground crew. And usually we let them, of course. And, you know, they will tell us, okay, can I do this and that? And they will do things and inform the ground crew. But most of the time, it's about following procedures.
Yeah, no, for sure. Now, there is obviously in these analog missions also a lack of weather. And we know many plants kind of respond to these rhythms of the Earth. Do we notice any differences or any changes in harvesting or in these plants because they're so isolated from that?
Usually, when you grow plants in a controlled environment, because you control the lighting, the temperature, CO2, humidity, and what you feed them, like the nutrient solution, you usually have a better yield than what you get in the field. And your plants grow faster because, you know, they have all the light they need, all the nutrition they need, and you don't have pests because it's a controlled environment. You just need to have a really clean environment, and usually you don't have these things that develop.
I can see how putting in that extra effort to isolate the plants from those kind of harmful conditions can really help you get more out of what you're putting into space. But honestly speaking, too, does this research and its results make you any more hopeful than before that we could be able to sustain ourselves in space and sustain our diets?
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying we can do it right now because we don't have the infrastructure like on Mars or on the moon to do it right now. But it's in the realm of possibilities. Of course, yes. We can grow plants, and we can grow plants in connection or conjunction to bioregenerative life support systems that will recycle things so that you don't need to bring as many inputs as you would otherwise. Really including plants in a system that recycles most of the resources you have, yeah, we would be able to sustain ourselves on other planets. The recent experiment with the chili peppers on the International Space Station, that's the first fruit growing on orbit.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, yeah, and there is another reason too. Because of the fluid shift, when they are in microgravity, they feel congested for most of their stay in the International Space Station. And so their sense of taste and smell is altered. And one of the condiment that they prefer on the space station is Tabasco. And so the chili peppers is also a response to that, because, you know, they wanted to have food that they can taste better. So this is also why we grew chili peppers on the space station.
Well, given all the information, you know, that we've gathered over the last 50 years, and also specifically with this crew time study, if you had to design and execute, you know, a really efficient space garden, what would be some things that are important to you, and how would you do it?
A really efficient space garden. Well, first of all, it would need to be integrated in the environment. So you don't design a space garden the same way if you are on an interplanetary travel, or if you are on the moon, or if you are on Mars. The environment of the moon and Mars are, I don't want to say similar, but let's say the moon can serve as an analog for Mars, but there are some things that are very different. Before designing a space garden, you want to really understand well your conditions. So we can imagine having a small leafy green production system that would come as a supplement for the crew diet. And this system would have full automation for watering and health monitoring. But then for activities like sowing and harvesting, it would not have to be fully automated, because it would be a smaller system. So the astronauts could still make these activities themselves. And this way, it would provide them an activity that's important during the interplanetary travel, because when we look into the journey to Mars, like 6 months to 8 months, it could be boring at some point. So if you have an activity with plants, a regular activity with plants, it also helps with well-being and psychological aspects of the travel. Then if you look at planetary surface type of system, in, you know, a couple of decades, we would have a bigger system, so a large-scale system for growing a lot of food. And so this system, as I said before, would have to be automated for harvesting, for sowing, and of course watering and health monitoring. But then because you increase your automation, you also increase the complexity of the system. And when you increase the complexity of the system, you increase the maintenance time. So we would gain some time in terms of not having to sow or harvest ourselves, or the astronauts themselves, but then we would have more time for maintenance. Now, maintenance time can also be drastically improved with the use of augmented reality, having some assistants that would tell you where to find things right away if, you know, everything is well organized from the start. So these were some of the recommendations we had.
So for our last question today, I love asking my interviewees, why did you come on the podcast today? And is there anything else that, you know, you want to tell our listeners or our audience members?
Well, I came on the podcast because I was invited. And first, I was really surprised that you wanted to talk about specifically crew time in this paper. Surprised, but, you know, happy surprise. I always like to share things about growing plants in space using bioregenerative life support systems and how we could live sustainably on other planets. And when I say live sustainably on other planets, what I have in mind is more scientific missions like we have in Antarctica right now. I'm not talking about moving humanity to Mars or something, just talking about scientific missions here. I like to share about what the research we do here and how we do this research in collaboration with other groups and how we can use different facilities here on Earth to help us simulate conditions in space and use that to predict what will happen on other missions. So I think crew time is something that is often overlooked, and especially crew time when we talk about growing plants in space, it's not something that comes to mind right away. But yeah, crew time is something we need to pay attention to for future space missions.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Dr. Poulet. Thank you for joining us from the Kennedy Space Center. Looking at your screen right now, it looks like any other government lab I've ever been in.
I have a rocket here.
Yeah, heck yeah.
I have a Saturn V.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I love that. Well, again, thank you so much. Thank you for your wisdom and your time. And yeah, we really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I was really glad to be able to talk to you today and share some of our research here with your audience.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Hi, Gina here. Thanks for listening to Science Decoded. We want to thank our host with the most, Justin Dingman, as well as our behind-the-scenes team members, Osama Ilian and Garrett Campion. Our channel artwork was designed by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was written and recorded by Graham Albright. We'd also like to thank our Patreon and local supporters. Without all of you, we couldn't do what we do. SciWorthy is an initiative of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more at www.bluemarblespace.org.